This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you want hard talk, or loud talk, or cross talk, right versus left talk, wrong station. And, well, if you're looking for opinion, wrong station. It's stories and only stories here on Our American Stories. And every once in a while, there's a little news, but it isn't your typical news. Actually, it's a look around the world, and it's our segment we call Jesse's World. And today, Jesse takes us through a walk along the wild side of government corruption.
A CEO of a mental health agency in Michigan is facing jail time for using public money to hire a personal fortune teller. Over the course of a year, 68-year-old Evan Brinker spent over $500,000 on a palm reader in Florida that he signed off as a healthcare consultant for his company, Summit Point. Brinker was charged with two counts of Medicaid fraud, conspiracy, and one count of embezzlement by a public officer and is facing at least 32 months in prison. The Attorney General's office says he will pay $1.2 million in restitution. Sheriff's deputies arrested the mayor of Jacksonville, Georgia recently on charges of driving under the influence of drugs and impersonating a police officer. Mayor John Dobson was driving a city police car when he was pulled over at about 4:30 p.m. He remains in county jail. Dobson's arrest is the result of an investigation which was initiated after a local citizen reported being stopped by the mayor in a marked patrol car. The investigation also revealed that Dobson is known to operate the police patrol cars on a daily basis as his primary means of transportation. Almost every top official in a remote South Texas city was arrested by the FBI recently under a detailed federal indictment that accuses them of taking bribes from contractors and sending city workers to help an illegal gambling operator named Mr. T. Crystal City's mayor, city manager, mayor pro temp, one of three current councilmen, and a former councilman were all arrested under an indictment obtained by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Antonio. Crystal City is a town of 7,100 people, about 50 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. Attorney for San Antonio said he hoped the indictment would help restore public confidence in local government, but that his office could only go so far. None of the officials will immediately lose their jobs. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Mr. T?
Mr. T.
Mr. T.
I pity the fool.
Man, that's really, I mean, Mr. T should be able to sue this guy. Because Mr. T's gotten really righteous, hasn't he? I mean, he's gotten the straight and narrow in recent years.
Well, there's been like five or six different Mr. T's over the years, hasn't there?
Yeah, so. There have. But, I mean, there's only one. I mean, we know there's the original Mr. T. Couldn't he? I guess you can't trademark a letter. Yeah. There's only 26 of them.
David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you?
And now we transition to our final thought segment. We hear from a dying person or people and or their loved ones. And this is a note we got from a friend of the show about his best friend. And he recently passed. Actually, it was last week. Cancer. Left behind his bride, a daughter, and a son. Well, 7 months ago, when he learned about the cancer was to ultimately consume him and kill him, he posted something for all of his friends. And so we wanted to read it, and this was Rhett, and we wanted to keep last names out of this for the sake of the family. But Rhett wrote this to his wife Karen, his daughter Dorian, and his son Remy. And it was titled, "So, Learn to Be Thankful." Among many things, this experience has taught me much about thankfulness. I have learned to be thankful for each new day that God has given me to live. I've come to realize that every day is a gift of time not to be squandered. I've learned to be thankful for my beautiful, loving wife, without whom I would not be the same person that I am today. I've learned to be thankful for my precious children and the opportunity to raise them and prepare them in my own warped way for living a meaningful life. And yet they somehow find a way to teach me something new every day, too. I've learned to be thankful for the taste of good food. You don't realize how much you appreciate it until you lose it. Ah, but when it comes back, he had lost the taste of food because of his chemo treatments. I've learned to be thankful for the care and companionship of good friends, the glue that holds your life together, making it stronger. I have learned to be thankful for my large family and extended family. They have no choice, but I think they love me anyway. I have learned to be thankful for the ridiculousness of this world that we live in. Each day brings news that entertains me simply because it is so absurd. I have learned to be thankful for all of these things, and they are just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more to be thankful for. And again, thanks to my good friend, you know who you are, and his friend, Rhett, his wife, Karen, his daughter, Darian, and his son, Remy. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Jeff Buckley, who himself died tragically at far too young an age, singing the great Leonard Cohen's masterpiece. More after this with Our American Stories.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I will show you around. I love it.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and as time change, well, some things don't. As Ben Franklin once said, it's impossible to be sure of anything but death and taxes. Well, if you're talking about Chicago, maybe we can add political shenanigans to that list. Late last year, the Chicago City Council passed a $588 million property tax hike that will hit homeowners' wallets over the next 4 years. That's the largest in modern history. Chicagoans should expect to pay at least $500 more in taxes per year for each $250,000 in assessed values of their property. Now, this is already law in Chicago and might be where the story ends, but actually, the key word assessed value is where our story begins tonight. And our guest is Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, and we love doing work with them, who has a front row seat to this Chicago show. Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Lee.
So tell us a bit about how these assessed values come to be in the first place. Is the property tax system in Chicago and Cook County as confusing and opaque as, well, almost everywhere?
So confusing and opaque are the right words to use. I'll try to put it in as simple terms as I can. So when you get your property tax bill in the mail, and as you said, Chicagoans are going to be paying, going to be shouldering a historically high property tax hike in these next few years. When you get that bill, on it, it says your equalized assessed value. That's of your property, of your home, of your whatever you may own. And your property taxes are then calculated on that value. Now, if you think that value is too high in Chicago, you can appeal that. And it often turns out to be the case that it is wrong. It was incorrectly valued by the assessor's office. This happens all the time. So what you want to do to appeal to get the greatest chance of getting your bill lowered is hire a law firm to appeal that bill for you. And most downtown properties in the loop of Chicago say that they'll retain a law firm to appeal that valuation. But as you said, the story doesn't end there. So three of Illinois' biggest political players either own or are involved in this scheme of property tax law. One of them is Alderman Ed Burke. He's been a Chicago alderman since 1969, and he owns a property tax law firm. Illinois House of Representatives Speaker Mike Madigan, also arguably the most powerful political figure in the state, he owns a property tax law firm specializing in Chicago property tax law. And then finally, you have Illinois Senate President John Cullerton, who works for a law firm who has a branch specializing in property tax law. So the state's biggest political players all get a bite out of this appeals racket.
Nice work if you can get it.
Great work. Very consistent, too, and very lucrative.
And let's talk about Madigan's six-person firm. What are they pulling down on this, on these tax refunds?
They've made, so over, I believe we looked at a one-year period a couple of years ago, and they pulled about $10 million in tax breaks for their customers. So it's not outlandish to say that Madigan's made millions of dollars over the years doing this. He's also been involved with getting tax breaks for a company that his son works for, Mesro Financial, in Chicago. They've appealed their assessed valuation to the Cook County Board of Appeals, and Madigan's firm has represented them. He saved them millions of dollars as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Now, so you hire one of these guys, one of these characters, and obviously you have to have the money to be able to afford to hire them. They're not being paid by the percentage like trial lawyers. They're getting, I would assume, paid by the hour, correct, Austin?
So, yeah, it's interesting. Madigan charges a flat rate, which is obviously very high. He's got a very exclusive clientele. I believe Burke does that also. Sometimes these guys take a percentage of the winnings. They take a cut off the top of whatever they can earn you back. But, as you said, I mean, in every dollar that they get saved for these corporations, that dollar falls on, Chicago families trying to make their ends meet. People are struggling in a really bad city economy. And meanwhile, they get to skim some of that money for themselves.
Yep. And again, it's one of these things where when the government gets involved, there are winners, there are losers, and there's gigantic transfers of wealth, Austin.
Exactly. So as with many things in Illinois, as you've heard speaking to us, it's the political class profiting off the suffering of the middle class, which is really sad.
And, again, when we're talking about these property values and the assessments, what kind of savings are we talking about, Austin? Can you give us just a couple of palpable or specific examples, or it was X and then it was Y after hiring a firm like Madigan's firm?
Sure. So it's all pretty opaque, but take the Mesro case. They saved about $5 million they're building on their tax bills over a period of 3 or 4 years. I actually looked at the Home Alone house, which everyone knows. So that's in northern Winnetka, but it's in Cook County, so it falls under the same appeals board as all these Chicago homes. They've paid $750,000 in property taxes alone since that movie was released. So if you imagine, so take that value and then put it on, say some massive, put it on Willis Tower in the middle of Chicago. Now imagine every single year the valuation is usually incorrect and they appeal it. And every single year, some attorneys make tons of money off of this. And then, as I said before, that burden falls on people who can't afford the connections to be able to appeal those sorts of things. And it's really a culture of corruption in Chicago. We see this with the property tax bill. It's not even a transparency issue on the property tax front because we know people are doing this, but we saw corruption, say, in the Laquan McDonald killing. We saw it in Barbara Bird Bennett, CEO of Chicago Public Schools. We saw it recently as the second in command of the Department of Transportation just pled guilty to federal corruption charges. It's a culture of corruption in Chicago, and this property tax scheme is just one little sliver of it.
Yep. And how does what you're describing in Chicago and Cook County compare to other big cities, Austin, a city like, let's say, New York?
So with New York, it's a bit different. They assess the values of properties every year. Chicago does it every 3 years. So they get a lot of stuff wrong when the housing market changes over 3 years. Another thing in Chicago, which is odd even among Illinois counties, is that we elect our assessor and we elect our board of review. So not surprisingly, the bulk of the contributions to those campaigns come from attorneys like Madigan and Burke, and it comes from developers who have cases before that board. So all those people are basically bought and sold, and it's to the detriment of, you know, just average Chicagoans trying to make it.
Well, you know, what's remarkable here, Austin, is you described the following scenario. If you're a home or business owner in Chicago, your basic choices are to either suffer the largest tax hike in modern history on properties that may be assessed way too high, or go to one of these high-powered lawyers who's politically connected, pay for those political connections in large measure, and then get yours reduced at the expense of the poor suckers or the poor folks who can't afford not to. What can people do about this, and what are you guys doing over at the Illinois Policy Institute to help?
Sure. So one of the biggest things we can do is it frees the growth of property taxes. So you see this historic property tax hike, all that scrutiny on that bill, that's going to equal big bucks for all these political insiders. So supporting a property tax freeze is huge, and that's across Illinois. People are getting crushed on their property tax bills. Another thing is just getting more educated about this issue. I don't think a lot of people know the extent to which the entire public ethics of the city of Chicago has been corrupted. It's almost a joke at this point. But there are some bright spots coming along the way. For instance, this week, city council, which has been without any local oversight since November, and let me repeat that again, this is one of the most corrupt bodies in American politics. They've been completely without a watchdog since November. They're voting to put themselves under the watchful eye of Inspector General Joe Ferguson, Chicago Inspector General. He oversees the operations of almost every other city employee except for city council and their staffs. So there's a vote this week that could put them under his control. Unfortunately, some aldermen, including Burke, are trying to make some behind-the-scenes deals to kneecap Ferguson. They don't want him to be able to audit their payrolls. They don't want him to be able to audit the workers' compensation system in Chicago, notoriously corrupt, controlled by Burke. So it's important that people get educated about these sort of behind-the-scenes moves by some of these, the more nefarious actors in city council to, at any turn, diminish oversight over one of the most corrupt bodies in the nation.
Well, Austin, thanks for all the work you're doing on this and the other things. And for folks listening who aren't in Illinois or aren't in Chicago, this is just, well, what's in Chicago today can be coming to a town near you. I know why my dad left New Jersey. His first property tax bill was a couple of $100 in 1961 on a $30,000 home. He paid for that home in 10 years. And what do you know? In 2013, when he sold that home, the property taxes were $15,000. $15,000. Austin, thanks so much for your work.
Thanks so much, Lee. Appreciate it.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And these housing stories, these, well, accountability stories, in the end, these citizens versus their own government stories are just a part of what we do here on Our American Stories, keeping you up to date before these things come into a town near you. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And from time to time, we dig into a book we think you need to read, and we really dig in. And one of the books we're digging into now, and have been for the past few weeks, and will continue to dig into, is Greg Ipp's Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous, and How Danger Can Make Us Safe. And I think it's such an important book because it tells us a lot about our economy, but it also draws on parallels that we all know in our own life. And again, anytime we can do anything here on Our American Stories that makes you a little smarter or can make you laugh, think, or cry, as Jimmy Valvano said in that great ESPY speech, that's what we're going to do. And this one made me think a lot, and it also made me laugh a lot to myself about things we know are true about human nature. And I think in large measure, this is a book about human nature. And Greg, who works for the Wall Street Journal doing their economics reporting, joins us now. Thanks so much, Greg.
Lee, thanks for having me.
You know, talk about what I just said there about human nature, because in the end, so much of what happens on Wall Street is about emotion. It's about human beings. And so much about what happens in this area you're writing about, which is risk and safety, is about human nature itself. Talk about that.
Well, you're absolutely right. And so let me sort of focus on one specific aspect of risk and safety, which is that when something doesn't happen very often, it's easy for us to believe it never happens. And then when that thing actually comes along, you often get panic. So we all saw examples of panic in the financial crisis. But let me bring up an example of a different sort of panic we're all familiar with. You hear about, for example, some people have gotten sick or died because there was E. coli on their spinach that they ate. Suddenly, everybody abandons spinach. And this is exactly what happened in 2006. There was a rash of cases of sickness and death due to contaminated spinach, and people just stopped eating spinach. Sales plunged. It took 2 years before consumption of spinach got back to normal, even though we know that it was a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of the nation's spinach supply that was actually infected. And this is exactly what went on in the financial crisis, where it was a small, we didn't know what portion of mortgage-backed securities contained these toxic mortgages, but all of them were abandoned. When a money market fund turned out to hold some Lehman Brothers paper, everybody wanted their money back. All these money market funds had shareholders demanding all their money back. And the next thing you have is a broad panic. And what does this tell us? It tells us that when something that we are not used to happening actually happens, it's very difficult for us to gauge what the sensible reaction is, and the result is panic. And it's actually that panic that often does more damage than the original problem that we're dealing with.
Yep. And that this gets to the core of chapter 3, which is titled Now is the Time to Panic, What to Do When Safety Fails. And, you know, talk about that in terms of the counterintuitive nature of these things. I mean, all those people who pulled out money out of their 401ks and moved it to cash. And these are ordinary Americans who may have panicked. And when the market was tanking, they pulled their money out. And then they were so afraid that by the time they got the courage to go back in, the market had fully recovered and all they had were losses across their books. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I think that, I mean, that's, I think it's often the nature of investors to buy high and sell low. What we saw in the financial crisis was much more serious because it wasn't just about losing money in your stock mutual fund, which a lot of people are kind of aware is going to happen. They were afraid of losing money in their bank account or in their money market mutual fund, which was supposed to never go below a dollar per share. And in fact, if you go through history, this happens again and again. And one of the people I write about in my book, Gary Gorton, he's an economist and a historian, and he showed how in the 1800s this would happen with banks. They would issue currency. In fact, in those days, banks issued their own currency. It wasn't federal government currency. And they said, we'll redeem this for gold if you want it. Then one bank would fail, and everybody would say, well, if that bank's going to fail, my bank's going to fail. They all rush to the bank. They demand their gold back. But banks being what banks are, none of them, they don't have enough gold to pay them all back. And so lots of banks would fail. So this thing would become almost self-fulfilling.
Let's talk about how so-called government experts evaluate risk, Greg. You do in your chapter 3. Again, now is the time to panic, what to do when safety fails. In this chapter, you write about the FDA and tomatoes. Tell us this story that I suspect is similar to how they evaluate drugs.
Well, in this particular case involved one of the jobs of the Food and Drug Administration is to track outbreaks of foodborne illness. In this case, there was one that they believed was tomatoes, and so they issued a warning, and so a lot of people stopped eating tomatoes, and that caused a collapse in demand for the for tomatoes. A lot of farmers lost a lot of money, but it turned out that after they investigated it further, that the real cause was peppers. So I don't fault the FDA for trying to do a good job to protect ourselves, but I think what that story tells us is that a lot of the time in these complex things, whether it's our food supply system or our financial system, it can be very difficult to know with certain what it is that's causing the problem. And the reaction is often, well, better safe than sorry. And so you have this overreaction. Give you another example. After 9/11, a lot of people refused to fly because they just thought they didn't want to tolerate the risk of being caught in a terrorist hijacking. And one economist studied this and discovered that more people, as a result, died on the highways in the months after 9/11 because they chose to drive rather than fly, which is safer.
Yep, that's so true. And, you know, I had spoken a while back to Nassim Taleb when his book Black Swan came out. And, you know, I'd gotten to know him, and then his next book came out, which was interesting. And I had said, what did you learn the most from The Black Swan? And he said, well, I learned the most is that people wanted to know when was the next Black Swan coming. And he goes, they're not going to know. They missed the point of the book. So the question becomes, how do people actually evaluate risk? And what do they do in the midst of a panic when they're sensing something's a panic, whether it's over spinach or it's over a mortgage panic or a stock market panic? What do we tell people, Greg?
It's pretty tough because people don't necessarily respond rationally. I mean, that's the nature of panic, right? It's that you think of things that are highly unlikely, but imagine you can suddenly imagine it happening to you. You can tell people that the odds of that plane crashing or a terrorist attack are like 1 in 1 million or 1 in 100 million, but they saw the headlines and they can picture themselves being in that place where the terrorists are going to attack. Now, Nassim Taleb is absolutely right. People don't understand that this is the nature of uncertainty, is that you don't know when. That's the nature of a black swan event, is that it doesn't fall within the normal range of probability, so it's impossible to predict it. The fact that we haven't seen it doesn't mean such an event can't happen. Well, how do you prepare for those sorts of things? Probably the best thing you can do is in advance to familiarize yourself with the possibility of this happening and to know what you'll do in that circumstance. So I know this sounds strange, but I mean, there is a good reason for doing fire drills and so forth so that you don't panic when something like that happens. In the financial world right now, the regulators are forcing banks to undergo what they call stress tests. They want to see, let's imagine that the housing market goes down or there's a big recession. What happens to the securities you own? What happens to the loans that you have? Let's see how you respond to that. And I think for all of us, sort of familiarizing ourselves, knowing what our own risk appetites are in advance is helpful. Can I tell you a funny little story about this?
Absolutely.
So there's an economist who wanted to study people's emotional reaction to fear. And what he did was he asked a bunch of his students, he said, I want you a week from now to get up in front of the class and tell a joke. And if you do that, I'll pay you $2. So half the students agreed to do it, and half the students decided not to do it. I'm sort of just guessing at the numbers, but yep, those are approximately the right numbers. Mm-hmm. Well, over the following week, as the actual date that the students had to get up and tell the joke approached, more and more of them dropped out. They backed out. They chickened out. Whereas none of the ones who had declined to tell the joke changed their minds.
Right, right.
Took up the offer and went out to tell the joke. Well, what does this tell us? It tells us that a lot of us do not really understand in advance how we'll feel when a stressful event actually comes along. And so it's probably helpful to prepare yourself for that eventuality and trying to guess. So if you know that you're that kind of person, don't sort of like offer to tell the joke in a week's time.
Right.
What
right.
does this mean for your 401k? If you think you're the kind of person who's going to panic when the market drops 5 or 10%, first of all, you probably shouldn't be 100% equities in the first place.
Right.
Second of all, you should probably set up a plan that rebalances you and takes the decision out of your hands and does it automatically for you so that you don't automatically sell when the price is low and buy when it's high.
Know thyself is really the advice here. This is Lee Habib. We're speaking with Greg Ipp. The book, Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Can Make Us Safe. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Thank you for having me, Lee.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and we'll be back after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And when you hear that sound, it means we're about to do our Shark Tank review. And we love this show. And, well, the people love it, too. It's the top-rated show on ABC on Friday nights. And then on CNBC, they're running in repeats, and it's the highest-rated show on CNBC in repeats. And then there's The Prophet, which is also just terrific. And Alex... Well, he turned
me on to that
show. We're
going to be interviewing him in a week or two.
Nice.
Great.
They're trying to set it up right now.
Great. And Marcus is a guy who, his specialty, if you ever get to see The Prophet, is he loves to invest in businesses owned by families. And what he sees often is a really good business, but what he's trying to solve is the actual family problems. And very often there are these emotional blockages And if people can just be realigned, capital can be, and they can just solve some of the problems that you need almost an outside guy to do. He unleashes the prospects, and he does it with his own capital. He sits there and writes these gigantic checks, and then he says, look, I'm in 100% control. And that ends up solving the family problem because they're not bickering anymore. They all agree that they can't run the business alone. And this it's actually really brilliant when you think about how to think about distressed assets. But really smart guy. And before I do that, I just wanted to hit one little thing my wife handed me. And everyone, she never hands me anything, but we do nanny state stuff. And obviously, we've been doing Greg Ipp's book. And in Oxford, the little town that we air from, she circled this out of the Little Oxford Eagle. We're a town of about 20,000, about an hour south of Memphis. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to do a big national show from a small town rather than big national shows from big towns to small towns? And by the way, even the big towns of this country are filled with people from little towns who move to big towns. And aldermen will be considering a new helmet law requiring anyone 1 to 16 years old to wear a helmet while riding a bicycle, electric assisted bicycles, electric personal assistant bicycles, mobility devices, inline skates, roller skates, skate shoes, motorized foot scooters, scooters, wow, self-balancing electric scooters, hoverboards, skateboards, and heck, maybe walking's next.
Yeah, no kidding.
This is crazy, and it gets worse. On Tuesday, the board decided to allow the Oxford Pathways Commission, so there's a commission for our pathways, to review the proposed ordinance and make any suggestions to enhance the proposed ordinance, and then the aldermen would vote the ordinance after three readings. As written now, a parent would receive a warning on the first violation, a $25 fine for the second, and a $100 fine for the third and subsequent violations. So, well, we like to keep track, wow, of these things because there you go again, the state and even the city moving in and telling us how to think about risk and our kids.
Sounds like a good opportunity for some good old-fashioned civil disobedience.
I think it could be. It could be. And that leads us to this week's episode of Shark Tank, and we met Griff and Lee, two former Army Rangers who have a line of clothing products that are made to help business-minded people in war-torn areas.
Hello, Sharks. My name is Matt Griffin. Please call me Griff.
I'm Donald Lee. Call me Lee. We're combat flip-flops, and we're seeking $150,000 for 10% of our company.
Sharks, we're here today to enlist you into the unarmed forces. What we do is simple. We make cool products in dangerous places.
In our past lives, Griff and I were Army Rangers. Our motto states, Rangers lead the way.
Hoorah!
Our mission is to create badass products by skilled entrepreneurs surviving in areas of conflict. This mission provides peaceful, sustainable change in areas that need hope.
Rangers lead the way. I love it. Love Griffin Lee already. So wait, he wants how much money for 10%? How much did they want?
Did they say it?
$150,000, Jesse? What was that? $150,000 for 10%. So they're pegging the valuation of their business at?
$1.5 million?
$1.5 million, yes.
Thanks for helping with the number. I got lost there.
Hey, you know, you do what you can do. By the way, my little girl formulates these calculations. She actually knows what businesses are worth based on projected sales. Next, with goods made from Colombia to Afghanistan out of material like decommissioned landmines, these guys, these Army Rangers, know their idea sounds, well, just a little cuckoo.
Our footwear is made in Bogota, Colombia. We support craftsmen, not cartels. Our belts, sarongs, scarves, and cashmere are made in Afghanistan. We employ women and put little girls in school. We partner with a demining organization, Elao, to make a line of jewelry out of landmines. Sharks, right now you're probably thinking we're crazy. And you're right. But somebody probably said the same thing to you once, and it didn't stop you. We know that businesses are more powerful than bullets. So Sharks, enlist in the unarmed forces today.
Wow.
These guys are good.
These guys are real good. And really, do you want to say no to two Army Rangers named Griff and Lee? I don't know. Here's how these guys serve their country and how they continue to help people across the globe through entrepreneurship.
We served with the 2nd Ranger Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment.
Where?
We did two tours in Afghanistan together. I did one tour in Iraq.
And did you start the businesses then?
We had always talked about starting a business together, right? And just through our experiences in Afghanistan, we found that we wanted to do more for the country other than go over there and be soldiers, right? We wanted to kind of give back.
And we thank you for that.
Well, their best-selling item is a pair of rugged sandals they call the AK. What does it cost to make? What do they sell it for? What are their total sales? And what are their sales this year?
So I'm going to speculate that these are your biggest sellers. They are.
What's it cost you to make them? What do they cost landed? And then what do you sell them for here?
So our full other models, the AK, those are cost us $20 to make. But right now they cost us $4.90 to land each. So right around $25 because we're airshipping them in.
Why are you airshipping?
Well, because we just haven't been able to keep up with demand. We were selling them as fast as we had them. For the past 3 years, we've been sold out of product.
What are you selling them for?
What were you selling for, yes?
We were selling them for 70.
Where were you selling them through?
Well, last year, we had 89% online direct through our website and 11% through wholesalers.
What are your total sales, Greg?
Last year, we did 134,000, and we just eclipsed last year's numbers. I think we're going to hit 300.
Will you make money this year?
We're already making money this year.
How much you make?
We're going to be at 5% net this year.
Well, 5% net doesn't generally excite these guys, but... Well, this is a different pitch from a couple Army Rangers who maybe can be taught how to squeeze some costs out of this. So Mark Cuban wants to know more about the business they have running overseas. The guys tell the Sharks about how they're helping young women with a business making swimwear in Afghanistan.
Hey, I'm a huge, huge, huge believer in business over bullets. And if we're going to have any impact on the rest of the world, we got to export the American dream. So you said you were making something in Afghanistan. Give me the scoop.
So we found a woman-owned factory, and we said, hey, can you make some sarongs? And their first question was, you know, what's a sarong? You're trying to talk about beachwear to Afghan women, and they don't know.
So I'm still shocked they let an Afghani woman open a business and have a factory.
Her name's Hasina Sherjan, and she left Afghanistan with her family when she was educated in America, and she heard that Afghan women were being persecuted. So she flew back in the mid-90s. She funded underground clandestine schools for girls during the years of the Taliban. Now she's managing all the secondary education for Afghan women.
She's taking the money from the factory that she's making and educating?
Yeah, and we're matching her.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. Mr. Wonderful, however, never always amazing, Mr. Wonderful. Well, he backs out. So the Rangers toss him a lit orange glow stick, something symbolic for time on the battlefield. Robert, well, he also bows out.
I'm finding the deal too diversified and not focused enough in terms of being an investment. So for me, I'm out.
I got some for you, Kevin.
What is that?
It's how we mark the dead.
Yeah! Wow.
I love that.
It's going to be challenging to keep growing. I'm out. Please don't give me an orange thing.
No, we're good.
Well, Mark, Damon, and Lori, well, they think differently. They all want in. Here's the offer.
So here's the offer. You ask for $150K for 10%. What we'd like to do is give you $200K, but for 25%.
So Damon's willing to let me in on that offer. We're splitting it three ways.
No.
Like I said, Lauren, we don't want you.
This is 12 and a half over here. You don't have to put up any cash, and you get to pick any of the products that you feel work for your outlets.
And what do I make from that?
You make your money, your markup.
Just on those products.
I would rather be a partner with you.
I think the business needs a feminine touch, guys.
No.
Thank you.
Well, then, look, if you're going to do that, then we're probably going to have to come back and ask for 30%.
Would you do a deal 30% for three sharks? That's a lot of horsepower.
We would have to up the cash to do that.
Well, maybe they will. You got to come back.
And again, remember the original offer? They wanted $150,000 for 10%. The Sharks want a third. That would mean, well, $450,000 is what the Sharks would have to pony up. But that's where the negotiation begins. The Rangers counter the Sharks' offer. But do they have a deal?
Can you do 300 for 30?
I'll do 110. I don't care. You guys?
Done.
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 Business.
It's good work.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Greg.
Thank you.
Appreciate everything you've done.
Hey, looking forward to working with you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We did it. It's awesome. We're going to help a lot of people and do a lot of good things. We think Mark's going to help us dominate the tech space where we want to be. Damon's going to help us with branding, and Lori's going to help with distribution. It's a dream team.
Right.
We couldn't be more excited.
Yeah.
Well, we couldn't be more excited for Griffin Lee, a couple of Army Rangers who, well, they haven't had enough with Afghanistan. They tried the bullets, and now they want to try business. And by the way, you hear this from so many people who go over there and serve. I have a dear close member of our family who spent 7 years in Afghanistan training up their soldiers. And it was really hard for him to leave because he really got to know the people there. And he said they're just great people. but they just, well, they don't have a good government. And my goodness, the Taliban's just waiting around in the wings looking to take it all over. And there's no doubt commerce could change everything in these places, and women could be free. Great work, Griffin Lee. Great job on this, Jesse. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories and our version and recap of Shark Tank, only on this show. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every day, we get into the mind, the disturbed mind sometimes, of our rock star producer, Jesse Edwards, and we call the segment Jesse's World.
Morgan Freeman will now guide you on your commute thanks to a new traffic navigation app called Waze.
Well, well. Look at all that traffic. I told you not to get on this freeway.
The 78-year-old actor has lent his voice to the app and will help get you to your destination by telling you when to make turns, along with some other fun phrases.
Looks like you chose the wrong path.
I'm doing everything you're telling me I'm supposed to do. I don't understand.
Kind of a metaphor for your life, really.
The feature can be unlocked by downloading the Waze app and changing the voice language settings to Morgan Freeman.
Where you want to go now, dummy?
A bizarre, allegedly leaked recording of an alien responding to messages sent by NASA into space is going viral online. A video has emerged which it is claimed includes a genuine recording of an alien reply discovered by NASA in 2012. But the recording, which includes the alien called Shive saying, "I come in peace," has been widely panned as a blatant hoax, even by conspiracy theorists known for their outrageous beliefs. And speaking of outrageous, talentless hack Kanye West was heard throwing a temper tantrum backstage at a recent taping of Saturday Night Live.
"Y'all ain't gonna do this. We breaking the internet. Get to it, bro. Bro, by 50%. Stanley Kruger, by 50% more influential than any other human being."
In his rambling, incoherent bloviation, Kanye can be heard comparing himself to Stanley Kubrick and Picasso.
"Don't f*** with me."
Kanye was reportedly upset by the quality of the set that Lorne Michaels had provided when he decided to throw his fit.
"Don't f*** with me."
You might be angry, too, if this is what your music came out sounding like during your crappy performance.
"This is everything."
For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Oh, you're so good.
Deliver us serenity.
No, make it stop.
Deliver us love. Lord knows we need it. Lord knows we need it.
I think you need it, Kanye. He needs deliverance from himself.
Oh, my goodness. So he's 50% more talented than Picasso? Is that what he said?
And Stanley Kubrick, I guess.
And Stanley Kubrick. He didn't say 50%, 50 cent, or he said 50%. I didn't get that.
I don't know.
I think he said 50%.
Bell! Bell! Bell!
How's the audience there at SNL?
Boo! Boo! Rubbish! Filth! Slime! Muck! Boo! Boo!
That's the general consensus.
Oh, I think so, too.
Oof.
Not a big Kanye fan myself, so don't understand it. Don't get it.
It's so bad, I think, at this point. He's maybe it's just an act because he can't get any publicity unless he's just completely terrible.
I'm just a naughty by nature guy. I'm old school rap when it was more musical and a little less angry.
And you could dance to it.
And you could dance to it and you could have fun with it. And even some of the social messaging rap, and I wasn't into it, but I mean, you could at least say, my goodness, there's some talent. I just don't get Kanye.
KRS-One,
yep.
Boogie Down Productions.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Kanye's a little bit in debt, $53 million.
That's it?
Yeah, and he tweeted Mark Zuckerberg, I know it's your birthday, but can you please call me tomorrow to give me a loan?
Give me some money?
And he went on, I'm this generation's Disney. I want to bring dope let's just say stuff to the world.
Dope stuff.
I don't have enough resources to create what I really can. Yes, I'm personally rich. I can buy furs and houses for my family. Ugh. But if I spend my money on my ideas, I cannot afford to take care of them. I'm in a place that so many artists end up.
Oh,
don't you just feel bad for him?
Woe is me.
I would rather listen to my dog lick itself for an hour than to listen to Kanye for another
Thanks
minute.
Thanks for that image, Jesse.
You just had to do it. Huh?
You know, speaking of music, I think it's time for a segue. That is some music, and that's Jimmy Page's guitar work, opening the song 10 Years Gone, on Led Zeppelin's sixth studio album, which came out tomorrow on this day in history, called Physical Graffiti. In 2006, this record went platinum 16 times, and it was a double record. And this is back in a day when a record would have a solid 1 minute opening like this. No words yet. I'm still talking. And only Zeppelin could have done this record. They recorded it in a home. Imagine that. In a home. And take a listen.
Then again it will be. Though the course may change sometimes, rivers always reach the sea.
Blind skies of fortune. A sound like you've never heard before. Young people still downloading this record. Let's take a listen to another song on this record, Custard Pie. And then, of course, there was the masterpiece on this record. Eight minutes long, I think, something like it. Kashmir. And we will close out with this song. It took a long time for this album to become record, said Robert Plant, because we originally went into our studio to record it. But one of our musicians, John Paul Jones, wasn't well. We canceled everything. 3 months later, we got the situation sorted out. And it came out pretty fast. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories on this day in history. Tomorrow, Physical Graffiti, recorded by Led Zeppelin. More after these messages.
Top of days for which they sit away.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and every other week, we'll bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. That's from the New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy. It profiles women who dare, what they dare to do, and why they dare to do it. This week, we're bringing back to you Gail's very first feature on a journalist who dares to give a voice to the Syrian rebels in their daring fight for their future against two mortal enemies, ISIS and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. We're bringing back the feature because this journalist was just detained in Bahrain as a, quote, suspected terrorist. We play Gail's feature and then hear from her live about this harrowing update.
Today's daring woman is a beautiful blonde 20-something American woman from Boise, Idaho. When she first started reporting from the Middle East in 2011, Anna Day stuck out like a daisy in the desert. But she stuck it out from day one of the Arab Spring in Egypt to the chaos in Syria today, 5 years later.
I realized, you know, instead of being frustrated that I'm often undermined because of my age and my youth, that I needed to really turn that into an asset. Mm-hmm. And the Arab Spring was the perfect climate to do that because, you know, I was interviewing my peers. The Middle East, 70% of the Middle East is under 30.
Wow, perfect.
So I got to, you know, interview and interact with them in a very different way because I was their peer.
Anna, what made you drop everything and fly into Cairo?
I had a lot of Egyptian activist friends who I had met while studying Arabic in college. When Tunisia fell to a revolution, they called me and they said, get down here, Egypt is next. I didn't think in a million years it would happen. I saw the conditions under which they had been organizing for years. It was very dangerous to be an activist there. But I said if I were to miss a revolution in Egypt, I would never forgive myself.
What was it like in the middle of Tahrir Square?
The first day of these protests that were called, I woke up and the blogs and a lot of the internet had been shut off by the government. Then I started walking towards Tahrir Square, and it was flanked with rows of police officers at every road that leads into the square.
A very clear sign.
As I reached the square, I heard a kind of chorus of protesters coming. And as I approached the square, they approached it from the other side, and I entered the square the minute they broke into the square and broke that police front line.
Wow.
For the first time.
So you were right on the spot. And how did you let news organizations know that you were there?
I got a million pictures from that moment. I knew I was in the middle of something really special. I saw women, young people, people who were Muslim and Christian of all backgrounds protesting. So I got those pictures, and that night I put them online saying the revolution has begun.
From Cairo, you began making a circuit of Middle East revolutions. You went from reporting in Egypt to Bahrain to the Libyan war. And then why Syria in 2011?
I met activists from Syria who had come to Egypt to learn about revolutions, and they started telling me about the kind of horror that was going on in their country and the lack of journalists. So these young people encouraged me and other journalists to come early on. So when these war reporters died inside Syria, many of the Western news organizations decided to pull out.
And that was the beginning of an almost complete shutdown of Western journalism in Syria. What was your impression of the war in your first year of covering Syria? Was it just another civil war like Iraq seemed to be in the beginning?
For me, I had never seen anything like it. One of my first experiences in Aleppo was in a hospital. I was inside doing an interview with doctors. One of those first barrel bomb attacks happened in Aleppo, and a stream of people started coming in. Women, children of all backgrounds coming in maimed, and I froze. I really didn't know how to handle that situation.
Never been in it before.
Never been
it's
in it
It's a total shock the first time.
Yeah, and I really froze. I didn't know to just continue photographing the streams of people coming in that were maimed.
Maimed.
And while in that moment where I froze, the hospital started getting shelled. By the fall of 2012, I felt I had seen enough war crimes that this war couldn't possibly continue into 2013.
The UN would stop it. America would stop it.
Mm-hmm.
The world, sane world, would stop it.
And now it's 2015. Yeah, a young man said to me, I said, okay, listen, like you have a gun now. Now you're a combatant. You're not the nonviolent protester. And he said, first of all, this is armed resistance. We're defending ourselves. They're bombing our schools and our hospitals and our homes. And he said, and secondly, this is our American Revolution. You guys defended yourselves from tyranny with guns, and we're fighting for our right to vote.
The fact that you were a woman, how did that work with Arab men?
A lot of them are very shy because they have a more conservative society. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been very protective. I've had Syrian rebels make sure I had my separate sleeping quarters, and they locked me in a closet in this little compound that they were defending, and they said, "We feel so bad, but this is your free Syrian hotel. Welcome." And they did bring me strawberries the next day, saying, "We wish we could bring you more than this."
You got an amazing scoop in 2013. The Daily Beast published it with this headline, "Dining with Al-Qaeda." They didn't even realize they had an even bigger scoop.
I sat down with a group of foreign fighters who were part of a group called ISIS.
Your publisher didn't recognize ISIS and changed the headline, called it Al-Qaeda, right?
Yes. And, a year later, obviously, that would have been the leading headline. And at the time, it just sounded like I was, too into the weeds of this story, making distinctions between these rebel groups. Mm-hmm. But inside Syria, that distinction had become incredibly important. And ISIS at that moment, not Al-Qaeda, had the momentum.
What did these guys tell you was their motivation?
So they were fighting a war of defense in many ways. They came to defend the women and children that I also saw being bombed, but they were doing it for a different end game than the Syrian people. The Syrian people were fighting for the right to the vote, while these foreign fighters are fighting for the reestablishment of the caliphate.
And they were eventually, it didn't take them very long to be fighting on both sides of the border of Syria and Iraq.
Yes.
And establishing the beginning of their caliphate.
Yes, that summer there were major developments on both sides of the border of Iraq and Syria, both because of the Islamic State. At the time in the West, we were still reporting on these two countries as separate theaters, and they were talking about developments in Iraq separately from developments in Syria. But the big point at that moment was these developments were coming with a very deliberate organization from one specific group.
What is your hope now that Russia is bombing to buck up the Assad terrorist regime? We don't know who's fighting whom. All we do know for sure is that the Obama administration has finally killed the Pentagon plan to train and arm Syrian rebels. A couple months ago, they found out their $50 million effort had provided only 5 rebels who didn't run away when there was an attack against them. So they've disbanded it. So we've walked away from the fight.
There's not a lot of points of opportunity in Syria, but there still are a few. And if the U.S. politically cannot get involved in a military capacity at this point, there's certainly a way to be involved in terms of absorbing refugees and in terms of supporting our allies in the region who do support refugees, our allies in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. So I think the U.S. has failed to lead in the civilian realm. But on a military realm, the people of Syria only asked for weapons after a no-fly zone was denied to them. So from their perspective, it was very logical. If you won't defend us from the jets that are bombing our elementary schools, then let us defend ourselves. Give us some guns, give us some anti-aircraft missiles and artillery to do something, to defend ourselves.
What kind of daring does this chaos reporting take?
Well, it would be a day-by-day risk assessment to make sure that, we're keeping our team safe and the Syrians that work with us on the inside, but also, honoring this story. We've seen so many of our colleagues die for this story. We've seen so many civilians live through this horror. And again, we see Assad emboldened by the lack of coverage and the lack of accountability. So a lot of journalists are committed to keeping this story in the headlines and conveying it and with the urgency that it will take to hopefully ignite some kind of policy change.
A very brave young American from Boise, Idaho, who's been risking her life for 5 years to keep reporting on this terribly sad part of the world. Thank you, Anna Therese Day.
Thanks, Gil.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and that was New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy's feature, Women Who Dare. After the break, Gail will join us live to bring us up to date on this story and Therese Day's story of her detainment in Bahrain as a suspected terrorist. More after these messages. More with Gail Sheehy. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and every other week, we'll bring you a feature called Women Who Dare. And that's from the New York Times bestselling author Gail Sheehy. It profiles women who do daring things and what they dare to do, and more importantly, why they dare to do it. And this week, we brought Gail back, and we brought back, as you just heard, our very first feature on a journalist named Anna Therese Day, who had dared to give voice to average citizens in the so-called Arab Spring revolutions across the Middle East. We did so because she was just detained in Bahrain as a suspected terrorist. Gail, why did this happen? What was the context? Give us a setting to the update on this story we did a while back.
Well, here you have a fearless freelance journalist, only 27 years old, Anna Therese Day, whose luck held out for 5 years as a freelancer documenting the Arab Spring in Egypt and Syria, Libya, Bahrain, and then in the last years, couple of years, the rise of ISIS in Syria, where very, very few reporters dared to go or were sent by their news organizations. But Anna Day was fearless. But in the last week, she went to Bahrain with a film crew to cover the fifth anniversary of a revolution that was unrelenting in that small Gulf kingdom. And she knew that there would be repression of the protesters, and sure enough, there was. And the curious thing was that from the main highway, this place looked like Singapore, glistening skyscrapers. It looked very luxurious. But beyond the highway, she could see smoke from tear gas and Molotov cocktails, and there was obviously something different going on in the neighborhoods. So she connected with the activists she had met when covering their revolution 5 years ago, and they took her to these neighborhoods where, on a daily basis, there were clashes between police and protesters for the last 5 years. And mothers and fathers and a lot of children were continually disappeared. They went into jail. Tortured bodies were released or thrown out in the streets as a warning to other people. They had one of the worst human rights abuses records compared to North Korea. And so she was where she wanted to be, to film what was going on in this very, very violently repressed Middle Eastern country.
And Gail, the consequences of her daring have been pretty stark. And we know how Western journalists are treated in these parts of the world. Heck, we know what happened to Daniel Pearl. Oh, my goodness. That was a pretty tough sentence. That was death. Talk about...
Well, we know what happened to Jim Foley,
you bet,
who was a colleague of Anna Day's and was beheaded on television. So that was the only time when she completely froze and couldn't write about that atrocity. But she was back again, 5 years after the original Arab Spring, having reported from Syria up till last year, and there in Bahrain. And the reason she was there, Lee, is that unbeknownst to most of us, Bahrain is one of the most strategically important military bases for the U.S. in the whole world. It's the home of our Fifth Fleet, and they are guarantors of the world's oil supply. And as a result, we haven't really heard any protests by the U.S. government about the human rights abuses in Bahrain. And Anna Day wanted to document those and bring that story out. But she was arrested and with her crew, and they were treated in a very terrifying way.
And she was, she, you know, it's interesting. She, the authorities there used Google to figure out who she was so they could then arrest her. And talk about that, right, Gail. It's fascinating.
Well, you know, we don't necessarily think that, you know, security forces in a little known island in the Red Sea called Bahrain would actually Google to find out who an American was. But they did, and they found out she'd written a story about a tweet written by one of the protesters in Bahrain. And because she repeated it in a social media in America, she was already suspect. And they were throwing around charges like terrorist, agitator, charging these four Americans with doing all kinds of, you know, with participating with the protesters rather than being journalists who were covering the protests, which is exactly what they were doing.
And what's been the sentence? What's been the punishment meted on this daring young journalist? What's happened to her, Gail?
Well, what happened to them was initially very frightening. They were separated, all four of them. She was taken to four different police stations around over through the night, asked to call the embassy, wasn't able to call the embassy, not able to call her lawyer or a family. So nobody knew. They were just, you know, they had disappeared. And finally, she couldn't stand it anymore. They handcuffed her feet and her legs, put her legs in irons. No food, no sleep, no water. Finally, she had to act like a crazy person to say, screaming and crying, I have to call the U.S. Embassy. You must let me call the U.S. Embassy. And they finally did. But even then, they were whisked off with her crew to a court where they were charged and given a sentence hanging over their heads of from 10 days to 2 years for being agitators. And again, she had to throw a fit and say, I am not going to prison for 2 years. You know we're journalists. You know we're only covering this story. You have to let me speak to the embassy. And finally, the embassy did come to show up for them. And the charges still hang over their head, but they were finally allowed to leave. However, all of their gear was taken, all of their cameras, all their laptops. The only thing that wasn't taken, which was Anna Day's being a daring journalist, her primary concern was the film they had shot. And when she was reunited with her crew, they said, where's the film? And she whispered to them, I have it. Don't ask where.
Good for her. Good for her. And Gail, you know, what's interesting to me is, I may even press you on this. I think this is one of these recurring stories that more Americans should know about. The repression of women in the Middle East, the repression of gays in the Middle East, the repression of human rights in the Middle East. Look, as we said before, just before we went on the air, there is a race to the bottom in this part of the world and in some parts of Africa right now for human rights that match or maybe exceed what's happening in North Korea, Gail.
Well, you can't really believe how widespread it is. And there have been lots of journalists killed in Bahrain. I mean, Bahraini journalists.
Yep.
Mothers and fathers, and especially children, young teenagers, are routinely disappeared in the middle of the night and kept in solitary confinement and often, you know, sexually abused, tortured until they confess, usually on camera, and then bodies dumped in the streets to intimidate future protesters. So, you know, what you have in the Middle East is the dominant population is under 30. So there's all kinds of hope for young people who are connected to the world, who do use Google on a routine basis, who know there's other ways to live than under this kind of repression. And in Bahrain have kept up a kind of minor revolutionary fervor for 5 years. But when you have that kind of repression and no other government, like the U.S. government that's there, challenging them on it, as we have done with so many other countries, they just get away with it.
Well,
so I'm glad to be able to report this story, and I hope that people will look at the website Jezebel, where the whole story is being written and will be there tomorrow.
Well, Gail, thank you for this reporting. Thanks for the continued work. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, Women Who Dare, an update on the life of journalist and rock star Anna Therese Day. This is Lee Habib. More after these messages. And this is Our American Stories. No, that's not the sound of our editing bay before we get to work. Though I wish it was. It's just a dad goofing off with his kids, making them laugh, tickling them, teasing them, making facial gestures. No better sound in the world than a human being laughing, young or old. Somehow as we get older, we don't laugh as much. Shame on us. I think that's why we have kids. And then they grow up and we want to pull our hair out. And we love doing stories out of the personal journal, the part of the Wall Street Journal that we know America loves, and the more Americans can get in touch with the personal part of the Wall Street Journal, called the personal journal, the better. It's in there in the fourth section of the paper. I start my day every day going there first to get my sensibilities tickled. And one story in particular caught our attention a while back, and it was, "Why Are Some People More Ticklish Than Others?" That was really the title. And I'm a curious guy, and it has a picture of a mom, by the way, tickling her child, and it's a beautiful picture. And I want to lead with the read of the piece. It starts off like this. Wiggly fingers approaching the armpits can elicit giggles from some people. For others, even a feather caressing the toes will bring about no response. Scientists are perplexed by the variability and the origin of the tickle response. And that's why we brought Heidi Mitchell on to join us. Heidi, thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So but before I even start, where do you get this story? I mean, how does this story stumble upon you?
Well, we have this column every other Tuesday in the personal journal section, and they are quirky, I'll give you that. This one came from the editor of the section, who happens to have, I think, a three-year-old. And so she was, it was actually her idea. She was wondering, how come he's so ticklish and I'm not ticklish at all? So we're all like hovering around 40, and did a little census, and none of us are ticklish anymore. So we wanted to know why the heck not.
Wait a second. Wait a second. You work with a bunch of people who aren't ticklish anymore? What's wrong with you all?
Well, you know, we took very scientifically a feather around and tickled people, and they didn't giggle. They giggled. You know, we giggle because we think it's fun and funny.
Right.
But that response of the actual tickle feeling, it just isn't there anymore.
And so tell me this.
Pretty much nobody.
And nobody. Tell me, and by the way, this is the burning question column, by the way, in the personal journal, and this obviously was the burning question you had to solve.
We are fun, interesting people at the Wall Street Journal that happen to not be ticklish, along with the rest of the world.
Wow. So let's work this down now. So you went and you talked to neuroscientists, and one, David J. Linden, and he was at John Hopkins. I mean, pretty fancy name, pretty fancy hospital. What did he teach you?
Well, I love this guy because he spends all day studying mice in the lab. And he happens to be, so he's a neuroscientist and he works on various responses in the brain, but he doesn't specifically work on touch. He's just a fanboy is what he calls himself. So he is a fanatic about our sense of touch and thinks that it involves many, many different senses. So he went around and spoke to all of these experts in the field and wrote this book, called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And he's fascinated with the subject, and he's fascinating to talk to, and he has so many thoughts, and he's a fantastic interview, which is kind of a rare find.
Yep.
So he was our guy, and he gave, you know, we like to call it an informed opinion, because a lot of times science isn't totally behind a lot of the subjects that we cover, like tickling. Not a ton of research on it.
Well, tell me this then. He, you know, as, and I'm going to read because I love reading from writers' work. And then you just advance the ball. At this point, early in the article, you write, some scientists have argued that being ticklish is a defensive reflex against attack. But Dr. Linden finds that explanation wanting. Why is that?
So if you think about it, it kind of seems like that's a good explanation, right? Like the places where you're super ticklish, you know, around your neck, where you have a major gland, where you have major vein around your, under your armpit. So that works. But then when you think about like your bottoms of your feet, well, that's not going to kill you in battle, right?
Right.
If you're stabbed in the foot or something like that. So that's why Dr. Linden believes that this isn't really a fully thought through idea. So he doesn't think that that's why we've evolved. All these things are evolutionarily based. I mean, I'm a firm believer in trying to understand why we do what we do based on evolutionary devices. So he doesn't believe, and I agree with him. He doesn't believe that it's a reflex against attack. Doesn't seem to carry through.
So then he goes on, and I'll read again. He compares being ticklish to having an itch, which most experts believe evolved as a protective measure against infestation by insects or worms. Talk about that.
Kind of gross, but yep. Kind of makes sense. Because when you're itching, when you have an itch, like a tickle, it's a specific kind of feeling that requires an immediate response. So unlike pain, which can be chronic or it can linger and you cannot deal with it, like a headache or a throbbing or something even that's acute but passing, an itch like a tickle, it provokes a very immediate response. So you might think that the tickle response is like, oh, there's like a worm crawling on me. I'm living in the cave. I'm thinking of caveman.
Right.
And I'm living in a cave and there's like a bug or something. And so it's ticklish. And so I go, ah, and I immediately push it away.
Right.
But honestly, and that seems to be a pretty good explanation because bugs tend to be tickly on us. But, you know, it hasn't been scientifically proven.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You wrote here, still, the neuroscientist says, we honestly don't know why humans are ticklish. By the way, I love it when a scientist can have some theories, but then just finally admit, look, we study this eight different ways. I'll tell you something else that was interesting, though. He says there is no indication being ticklish is inherited. He has seen tickling across every culture. So imagine this. He's studying tickling across cultures and says the behavior is often informed by social norms, taboos, and the setting in which it takes place, which, by the way, would be my theory. He says then, if someone is really angry, you can't tickle them. Talk about that, the setting.
So I think that the non-inheriting part of it is so fascinating, right? Because you often hear people say, oh, I'm ticklish because my dad is so ticklish, you know, and it's just never, there's no link proven. He said, I wish I could just, you know, take the ticklish part of your feet and dissect it. And I'd find like a whole bunch of neurons affiliated with the tickle response, but it's just not there. Just doesn't exist. And even though, and actually he's seen being ticklish across every single culture, yes, and also in lemurs. He said he's seen videos of lemurs that seem to have a human-like response to being tickled. And you've seen it with, like, your dog, your cat. I mean, they seem to, like, enjoy it. I don't know if it's the same quite response, similar response, but not quite the same. But what is so important is the situation. So tickling, unlike many other of our responses, is so situational. So if you're in love with somebody and you're having a moment and you're looking into each other's eyes and he like caresses your face, you know, you might tickle and giggle and it feels good. If you're in the middle of a heated argument and he does the exact same thing, you're not going to feel that same.
Oh yeah, I've tried that one. That doesn't work. My wife doesn't let me do that. That doesn't get me anywhere. Let me share this from you.
It's not going to break the argument, that's for sure.
Not breaking the argument, maybe breaking a bone in my body, actually. I got to be careful when I get too clever.
Elbow.
Exactly. So most people, you wrote here also, aren't able to tickle themselves. And here's where the doctor says something interesting. When you go to tickle yourself, your brain is sending a message to the tickling hand, and a copy is going to the cerebellum, which sends inhibitory signals to dampen the sensation, We know this because people who have damage to their cerebellum are able to tickle themselves, says Dr. Linden. Now, this is really fascinating. I've never actually tried to tickle myself. I went ahead and actually did try, and I couldn't. And I am still very ticklish. We'll get to that in a second. Talk about why, as people get older, they tend to lose the ticklish sensation they once had.
Well, first of all, the not being able to tickle yourself thing is so interesting, because basically what's happening is, and this is again evolutionary, so you're walking down the street and your clothes are kind of rubbing against you and they're kind of tickly if you were to think about it. Mm-hmm. But you don't think about it because you have to think about, well, am I being attacked? What food do I want to eat? Who do I want to mate with? So our bodies, our minds have evolved to take that signal of your clothes rubbing against your body, just as an example, or your hand moving toward your wrist to caress it, and copies that message and sends it to your cerebellum. It says, just don't think too much about that. It's not important. Focus right on, you know, mating and finding food and shelter.
Right.
So that's why you can't really tickle yourself. As far as getting older, you know, it's not totally proven, but the feeling, the thought is that as starting at age 20, you start to lose a little bit of your nerve endings on your skin as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very small, like 1% a year.
Right.
So that old people maybe don't have any feeling of any sensation on the bottoms of their feet, which is one reason why maybe they fall more often. It's just one of many, many reasons. But there's other responses that the nerve endings are no longer quite attuned to, like heat and cold and pressure and pain. And so as we get older, yes, we become less ticklish. It's just one of the many senses that diminish as we get older. So I guess if you live to 100, like we're all going to live to 100, we won't be hot, we won't be cold,
awesome,
and we won't be ticklish.
Some good things come of this.
Won't feel pain, maybe.
Heidi, we love this. Email us when you have stories like this. Heidi Mitchell, tickling the Wall Street Journal. Go figure. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Back with more after these messages.